Tonight we begin a look at the Gospel of John. You know, one of the things I've been doing, and I think a lot of you know this semester, driving back and forth to Henderson, teaching a couple of classes, and one of the challenges is getting to know your students. And you've got, I only have two classes right now, but in one class I have 16 students, and in another class I have 41 students, and they're from all over the country and even the world. And I've got a student in one class from Costa Rica, for example. The challenge is getting to know them, and each week I try to learn a few new faces. And one of the things I've told them, I said, my mission is to call your name once before you get out of my class. And so we're working hard at it. The class of 16, that'll be okay, but the class of 41 is going to take a little work. So I try to work at it each time we come to class. I try to leave class being able to identify a new student by name and know a little bit about them and where they're from. And so it's been enjoyable getting to know them. And I just discovered this week that they've got this neat online thing at the school that lists not only the names of all your students, but their pictures. And so I have printed me out this neat little cheat sheet, okay? And so I can look at their picture and say, hi, Gene, how are you today? And so I've been practicing with that and tearing it around with me and trying to learn. Sometimes it's a struggle to get to know people. Even when you want to get to know people, it's not always an easy thing. I want us to talk about getting to know Jesus. John wanted us to get a picture, in the words of the Gospel of John, of his Savior. He didn't have a Kodak. He didn't have a Polaroid. He didn't have a Sony to take a picture and send to us down through the ages. But he did have a pen. And he took the pictures that were in his mind of a life lived, a life that touched his life. And he sat down and wrote down how that life changed him and how that life changed others and how that life changed the world. So I want us for the next few months to look at the picture he paints with a pen to help us to know his best friend. We're looking at the Gospel of John, and my apologies to our college and young professionals class who were 6 or 8 months ago finished looking some at the Gospel of John. I didn't know at that time that that was going to end up being the Lads to Leaders book for this year. You know, each year we try to do a series dealing with what our young people are studying in Lads to Leaders so that we can connect what we're doing to what they're studying and hopefully give some things for families to talk about and study and share together. As we focus on this, I've titled this Encounters with Christ. We're not going to do a verse-by-verse study of everything that's in the Gospel of John and start in chapter 1 and look at everything. What I've chosen to do is, again, look at encounters that Jesus had with people in the Gospel of John. In particular, in the following weeks, I want to look at 12 encounters that Jesus had with different people. These are not all of the encounters in the book. These are just some I picked out that give us a picture, I think, overall of the book and the difference Jesus can make in a life. We're going to look at everything from encounters with the money changers, and that wasn't a positive encounter, to the feeding of the 5,000. And as we walk through each of these 12 encounters, I hope we'll get a clear picture of Jesus, and I hope we will have an encounter with Christ as we see these people having an encounter with Christ. The biblical bullseye I have in mind, especially for tonight, is that basically John shows us how his best friend can be ours. He wants us to know that his friend can be our friend. So let's take a few moments tonight, and we're going to look at 12 encounters with Christ that follow. But as we think about introducing the Gospel of John, I want us to begin with the encounter that lies behind the book. John wrote down about these other encounters with Christ because he first had an encounter with Christ. The scholar B.F. Westcott talks about the fact that when you look at the Gospel of John, there's some things that seem to jump out at you about whoever that author was. First of all, he was a Jew. As you read through the book, you're going to find him often making references to the Old Testament. He's going to often refer to the Hebrew Bible. He's going to have knowledge of certain customs that relate to the Jewish people. In other words, he speaks about Judaism as an insider. He's one of them. He understands their world. For example, when you read the Gospel of Luke, or when you read the book of Acts, you learn very quickly that the guy who wrote that book or those books was not a Jew. When he talks about the Hebrew Aramaic language, he'll talk about in their language it means so and so. But in John, you're dealing with somebody who's a Jew. He talks from that perspective. But he not only speaks as one who is a Jew, but he speaks as one who is a Judean Jew, a Palestinian Jew. He knows the geography of the region. And as he describes things, he describes the land, and he describes where they went and distances and so forth. Not like somebody who's from somewhere else who heard about it, but like somebody who's lived there, who's traveled those roads, who's been to Galilee, who knows the distance from Bethany to Jerusalem. And so I just want us to see that he comes across as someone who knew the local landscape. So he comes from a Jewish background. He's somebody that we think, from the way he writes, lived in and around Judea and Jerusalem. We also find that he was an eyewitness of a number of the things that he talked about. And I hope you're struck with, as you look at John, whether it's in this study or studies on your own, struck with all those details. For example, when he in chapter 2 talks about the wedding feast in Cana and the water to the wine, he tells you exactly how many water pitchers there were and how full they were. When you have the miracle that's performed in the catch of fish that's over in John chapter 21, he's not going to just say they brought in a catch of fish. He's going to say, oh, there were 153. He may have been one of the ones who counted them. In other words, he writes as if he's somebody that's there, somebody that saw and shares insider details, not just about the geography of the land like somebody who lived locally, but he writes like somebody who saw Jesus perform these miracles, heard Jesus teach these lessons. Westcott also talks about the fact that the author of the book of John writes like an apostle. He writes like he's among them. He knows about private conversations, about private disagreements and struggles between them. He seems to know their inner thoughts and what they're thinking about in kind of an insider way. In other words, he writes like he's been hanging out with the apostles. And he knows a great deal about them. Not an outsider writing about an apostles, but the apostles, an apostle writing about the apostles. But then ultimately he brings it down to John. He talks about the fact that in the Gospel of John, John's never mentioned by name. I mean, if you were to think of the other Gospel accounts and the leading apostles, I mean, by the time you get to the book of Acts, who are the two leading apostles that you are introduced to? It's Peter and John. Peter and John are running together. For example, when Jesus was making arrangements for the Last Supper, who did he send into the city to make arrangements? He sent Peter and John. Who was it that healed the lame man at the gate called Beautiful? And then who were those two apostles, those same two men who were thrown into prison and ordered by the chief priests to stop preaching about Jesus? It's Peter and John. In other words, whether you're looking in the other three Gospels, whether you're looking at Matthew, Mark, and Luke, or whether you're looking at the book of Acts, John is a very, very important figure in the early church and among the apostles. So why is it that we find him in Acts, and why is it that we find him in the other Gospels, but then in the book of John, he's gone? I mean, he mentions other apostles, but John is not mentioned by name anywhere. In fact, not only is John not mentioned by name, his brother James is not mentioned by name. And as you go through the book, you've got all of these references to the other apostles, but John's just not mentioned, and James is not mentioned. And you got to figure out, why would the author of a gospel leave out two of the key characters, two of the inner circle of apostles that were closest to Jesus and were there with Him at the pivotal moments. One logical answer, and to me the most logical answer, is it makes a lot of sense if the one who wrote it was John. If he made the decision that in the book he wasn't going to glorify himself and mention himself by name, and so he does make reference to the sons of Zebedee, he mentions his father, and he's going to mention his mother, but he doesn't mention his name or his brothers, it makes sense in the book if they're not mentioned by name, if it's John just trying not to bring attention to himself. And likely John knows that everybody knows who he's talking about when he gets to those places and there's an unnamed disciple there. Because you've got to remember, by the time John writes his gospel, Matthew, Mark, and Luke have already been penned, we think. And so many have read them or been exposed to them or have been exposed to the oral teaching about Jesus. So they know the stories. And so John simply chooses not to mention his name. But he's there. Throughout the Gospel of John, you've got this unnamed disciple that's there at strategic moments. And he's described throughout the Gospel as the disciple whom Jesus loved. Now, some folks think that if John is saying that about himself, that that's fairly arrogant. I choose to view it differently. John does not in the book say that he's the only one Jesus loved. But I find it fascinating that as John tried to think, how do I describe myself? How do I look at myself? Who am I? What gives me value and worth? How do I identify myself without my name? I'm one loved by Jesus. He's actually going to make reference in the book to the fact that Jesus loved the other apostles. But I just find it fascinating that all through the book he described himself as the one Jesus loved. And isn't that a great way to think of your life? Because the fact is, everybody in this room could say that. God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son. Every person in this room can introduce themselves as, "Hello, my name is so-and-so, I'm loved by God." "Hello, my name is Kirk," or "My name is Kathy," or "My name is John, and I'm loved by Jesus." That's a pretty good way to think of your life. And it seems that that's how John chose to describe himself in the book. It's interesting at times where you see in the book this unnamed disciple. I think the first reference for me is in chapter 1. There he's not referred to as the disciple whom Jesus loved. But in John chapter 1, it simply says there were two disciples that were traveling with John the Baptist. And John the Baptist pointed those two disciples to Jesus. They spoke to Jesus, went home and spent the day with Him. And it mentions one of them, Andrew, but it just happens to not mention the other. But it's interesting when you see this encounter that the author of the book mentions the exact time of day that they went home with Jesus. That makes a lot of sense if one of the two might have been John. And John could tell you, oh, it's either 10 o'clock in the morning, depending on what time reckoning you use, or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. He's describing the day that everything changed in his life. That doesn't mean that was the first time he had met Jesus or knew anything about of Jesus. I think from the biblical text, they were cousins. But I think that was a day when he really began to see who his cousin really was. And he remembered the very hour, the very moment when he spent the day with his master. If you look over in John chapter 13, you're at the Last Supper. And Jesus has begun to speak of someone who is going to betray him. And as he's talked about that, it says they are reclining at the table. And best I can piece together is what they would often do is have pillows around the table when they were eating or reclining, and they would often lean on one elbow, usually their left elbow, with their feet stretched out away from the table. So you'd have one lying like this and one lying next to that, next to that. So Jesus would have one on either side. And it says that there was an unnamed disciple described as the disciple whom Jesus loved leaning upon his breast. In other words, as John is leaning on his left elbow, he can kind of lean back and talk to Jesus, and Jesus can talk directly into his ear. And it's ironic when we piece together the account, it seems that John was on one side and Judas was on the other. On one side, one of his best friends, the one friend who didn't deny him, the one friend who was there in his trials as much as any of them were, the one friend who stood closest to the cross, and then on the other side of him was the one who should have been a friend that betrayed him and paved the path to the cross. I think there's tremendous irony and sadness in thinking about Jesus eating that meal between those two friends. But as Jesus began to speak of betrayal, the others are saying, who's he talking about? Which one of us is it? And so it kind of says, Peter eyeballed John, who was right next to Jesus, and says, you ask him. And you just get this sense, these are just friends. Sometimes when we look at, use words like apostles, and we look at them performing miracles and preaching sermons that would change the world, sometimes we forget these are guys. These are men. These are people. And so you can just imagine the network of friendships. And when he starts saying one of the group is going to betray him or do something in some way against him, they want to know. And so Peter looks at his buddy John and says, you're by him, you ask him. You ever done that in your homes? Kids want to find out something, and so Susie says to Sally, you go ask Dad. No, you go ask. No, you go ask. Peter says, ask him. And it was to John that Jesus said it would be the one that he would dip the bread with and hand to. Now what's interesting is that then Jesus proceeded to hand it to everyone, and it's not completely clear whether John grasped that it was exactly Judas, and it seems that maybe he didn't. But there's an intimate conversation that John didn't forget, and that when he wrote his book, it was a conversation that he recorded. If you look in John chapter 19, you have another encounter with this unnamed disciple when Jesus is hanging on the cross. One of the things you're reminded of is that the disciples forsook him and fled. But there was a disciple who was known to the high priest, according to the Gospel of John, who stayed with Jesus for the better part of his trial and made it possible actually for Peter to get into the courtyard. And most believe that unnamed apostle was John and had connections somehow through his family to the high priest family. But when Jesus was hanging on the cross with so many afraid to be close, and again, how close were they? I don't know, but they were close enough they could have a conversation. And when Jesus looked down from the cross, he saw a group of women who had been faithful to him. And with them, he saw one apostle he could count on. He saw his cousin John. Maybe he thought about the fact that he couldn't count on his brothers at this moment. His brothers would later become believers, but they're not believers now. If you go back to John chapter 7 and verse 5, it makes it clear that at least at that point, the brothers of Jesus, the earthly brothers of Jesus, didn't believe that he was the Messiah. And so Jesus is the oldest boy. His job is to take care of mama. I think by this point in his life that his father's dead. And so who does Jesus turn his mother over to? The brother who doesn't believe, or the cousin who's standing by the cross? He chose John. It's a moment he would never forget. And he said from that day forward, she moved into his home, became his mother. In John chapter 20, it says, on the first day of the week, Mary of Magdala had gone to the tomb and found that the tomb was empty. And so she ran to find some of the apostles. And it says she found Peter and the disciple whom Jesus loved.
And the text says they both took off running to the tomb. And again, I find this of interest, maybe almost a little humorous, and maybe you don't see that, but I find it interesting to see the humanity coming out. The author of the book says the disciple whom Jesus loved outran Peter to the tomb. He was the faster runner. I couldn't help but think of the conversations that the Gospels bear out that had happened among the apostles on who was the greatest and who would be greatest in the kingdom. Here John just kind of makes an offhanded comment, "I run faster than Peter. I got to the tomb first, but I looked in, but I didn't go in." And kind of consistent with Peter, he's the one that always runs in and then asks questions and figured out whether he should have later. He runs into the tomb. And they look and see that the body is not there. And it says in verse 8, "So the other disciple who had first come to the tomb then also entered, and he saw and believed." At this point, they don't necessarily believe he's resurrected, but they do believe the story that he is no longer there. Then look over in chapter 21. We're now in the aftermath of the cross and the aftermath of the resurrection. And seven of the apostles have gone back to Galilee and they're fishing. And someone comes walking on the seashore. They've fished through the night. And this unnamed disciple, this disciple whom Jesus loves, looks up and says, It's Jesus. Peter's so anxious to see him, he dives in the water and swims to shore to see him, and the rest of them come along in the boat. And you have that encounter where they eat breakfast there on the shore and Jesus confronts Peter and says, "Do you really love me more than these love me? Feed my sheep, feed my lambs, follow me," Jesus says to Peter. And then Jesus says to Peter, "There is a day coming, Peter, when your hands are going to be bound and you're going to be led where you don't want to go." And he was making a prophecy about how Peter would die. And the text says that Jesus and the apostles are walking apparently along the shore, and Peter happens to look over and see this unnamed disciple, this disciple whom Jesus loved. Now remember, Peter has just been told he is going to die. He is going to be bound and led where he doesn't want to go. Remember, Peter and John worked together and traveled together and taught together and did miracles together. And so he sees his buddy John, the disciple whom Jesus loved, and he says, "Well, what's going to happen to him?" And Jesus says, "Well, if I want him to live till I get back, what business is that of yours?" And it's interesting that the writer of the book goes on to say that a rumor started that said that he wasn't going to die. And he says, "Now, I want to clear up the rumor." He didn't say he wasn't going to die. Jesus just said, "If I want him to live till I come back, it's none of your business." Okay, that's basically the interpretation. And again, it's fascinating, if the one he's talking about, this unnamed disciple, this disciple whom Jesus loved, is John the apostle who wrote the book, that as he finishes the book, he says, "Oh, and by the way, let me clear up that rumor that's been spreading about me. Everybody's been saying Jesus said I would never die. That's not what he said. He was just saying to Peter that it's Jesus' business what happens to John. It's not Peter's business what happens to John." And in those stories, if he's talking about himself there, and my belief is that he is, it gives us fascinating insight into their relationship. And notice what it says in verse 24. "This is the disciple who is testifying of these things. And we know that what he says is true." He's saying, "I was there. I experienced this. And I'm telling you the truth." His father was Zebedee. His mother was Salome. I think possibly the sister of Mary. His brother was James. They were fishermen in a fishing business together with Peter and John, and they did well enough that they had servants. And so they may not have been filthy rich, but they might have been the first century equivalent of middle class. They did well enough that they could hire others to work in the fishing business with them. As you look at the weakness of James and John, it seems at times they could be outspoken. Like Mark tells us of going into a Samaritan village that wouldn't accept Jesus, and they said, "Do you want us to call down fire from heaven?" But it's interesting that one would be nicknamed by Jesus as a son of thunder because of that temper, that boisterousness, would come down through history to be known as the disciple of love. He talks about love in his writings more than any other New Testament writer. You probably heard the legend of how late in his life, when he could no longer walk to church, the Christians would carry him to church. And this tradition that's been passed down through the centuries said that he got to a point that he really couldn't preach anymore. And so when asked to speak, he would just simply say, "My little children, love each other." I don't know if that's truth or just tradition, but I do know that when you read the writings of John the Apostle, whether it's the Gospel of John or 1st and 2nd and 3rd John or Revelation, love permeates most every page. What was it that changed him? It was an encounter with Christ. If you look in John chapter 21, it says, "This is the disciple who is testifying of these things and wrote these things. We know that his testimony is true. And there are also many other things which Jesus did, which if they were written in detail, I suppose that even the world itself could not contain the books that would be written." In other words, John says, "I could have talked about so many more things. I had to pick and choose. I couldn't write it all." And so as he made a choice, it seems he kind of broke his writing into two parts. Basically, half of the book he dealt with the ministry of Jesus, and the other half of the book he dealt with the last week of Jesus' life. 92% of the Gospel of John is new. And the book begins at creation. Begins, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." And it ends with him commissioning Peter and the apostles to carry on his work. And what he does is he hand selects 7 miracles from the ministry of Jesus. And then he hand selects 7 I am sayings from the teachings of Jesus. And using those 7 miracles, and at times the 7 miracles connected to the 7 sayings, sayings like, "I am the bread of life. I am the light of the world. I am the true vine." At times, the 7 miracles are connected to the 7 sayings. And what he's trying to do through them is to show a picture of his Savior. He picks very specifically precious moments from his encounters with Christ. He says, "Truly, many other things could have been written in chapter 20, but he says, these are written that you might believe." You know, anytime someone applies for a position, our search committee here is doing this, they'll have references on the page. Because you get something in from somebody, and if you don't know them real well, or maybe you've heard about them, but you don't know things intimately about them, it's handy to have some references down at the bottom of that application or at the bottom of that resume. And so you call somebody there, maybe you see somebody, it's a reference that you know, and so you call them up and you say, "Billy or George or Fred or Sally, tell me about so-and-so. He's applied for this position." They say, "Oh yeah, I know him well. He's one of my best friends." It's easy to talk about your best friends. It's easy to talk about Cindy. It's easy to talk about my daughters. It's easy to talk about my friend David Wright. It's easy to talk about friends whom you love. That's all John is doing in the Gospel of John. Jesus became his best friend. And all he's saying in the book is that my best friend can be your best friend. John came to believe in Jesus and it changed his life. And he tells us that if we believe in Jesus and make him our friend, he can change our lives. If you would be willing to make that change and you would like to study and talk about how to become a friend of Jesus, or if as friends of Jesus we know we need to make changes, then won't you come as we sing this invitation song and let's talk about it and study together. Please come.